I'm Aisling Keenan and you're listening to Every Mum the Podcast, now in its 13th season and supported by Waterwipes, the number one baby wipe brand in Ireland, made with simply two ingredients and nothing else. When I had my daughter, I wanted something I could trust to use on her skin, and Waterwipes were and still are the one. I once made the mistake of trying a different brand and never again. I didn't realise just how much of a difference there could be between two fairly similar brands, but it was huge. My daughter is now almost three, and I still panic if I don't have at least one pack of water wipes within line of sight. With that in mind, I'm happy to say that this season is supported by that most essential of products for every mum, water wipes. Winners of seven National Parenting Product Awards 2023, including Best Baby Wipes and Best Baby Newborn Essential, they are ideal for delicate newborn skin. Together, we are committed to providing more support for parents with trusted products and this podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Every Mum the Podcast. I am Aisling Keenan, your host, and my guest for this episode is Jessica Burke, otherwise known as the Fertility Detective. She's known among her followers and her patients for her honest and straightforward and compassionate approach to all things fertility. And as she says online herself, she has nearly two decades of experience helping people to get pregnant and to stay pregnant. So before we start listening to this week's episode, I just have to let you know, we do speak quite extensively and in detail about what it's like to go through various types of miscarriage. So that's just something to be aware of if that's a subject that's sensitive for you at the moment. Jessica is a total pro, and it was so clear from chatting to her just how much of a vocation her job is for her. I know you'll learn so much from this one, just as I did. Enjoy. So Jessica Burke, thank you so much for joining me today on Every Mum the Podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Not at all. Thrilled to be here. Thanks so much, Aisling.
So we were just talking before we start recording about the fact that you, well, we have been attempting to record this for a while, and I lost my voice, and then sure, you lost yours, and we were both, neither of us could speak.
It was great crack altogether.
Great crack altogether.
I know when I messaged you and then you were... like, no, can we reschedule as well? We were both saying the same thing. It's like, it's the same bug going around. So no,
it's
one of those things.
So, and I had never, ever lost my voice in my whole life. So it was really unusual for me not to be able to talk. And in the line of work that I'm in, it's a huge issue, as you can imagine.
Yes.
But you were saying that you were at the Future Fertility Show at the weekend. How did that go? It must have been amazing. I really wanted to go, but I couldn't get across. Was it great?
It was genuinely phenomenal. And you know, I'd be straight up about this.
Yeah.
Genuinely, because I think it actually exceeded the expectations of, I would imagine, all of the attendees and indeed those of us who were there as exhibitors and giving the fertility advice to people. And I think a lot of that, well, probably the vast majority, is down to Nikki and Liz and their great team, who obviously run the Future Beauty Show. And this was then the kind of pop-up version of the Future Fertility Show.
Because it's
never been done in the country before, which is actually really hard to believe. And looking around over the weekend, I think what really struck me, I was expecting to speak to people, you know, everyone's stories, which were still very touching, but that I was prepared for. But having everyone under one roof, all the different, you know, different types of disciplines related to fertility, from, you know, doctors and consultants to acupuncture, reflexology, nutrition, dietetics, doesn't matter what it was, everyone was under the one roof with the same goal, which was to help inform people, support them, you know, encourage them in the next phase of their journey. And the first of many, I hope.
Brilliant. Yeah. And I'd say it must have been really helpful for people to have access to all of those experts in one spot, because, you know, yourself, we all know fertility is an incredibly expensive process. So if you're having to go to, say, for instance,
a dietitian, and then the next week you're going to a consultant, a private consultant, and the next week you're going to an endocrinologist or whatever the disciplines might be. That racks up cost pretty damn quickly. So to have those experts there to even just, hear a little bit from, maybe have a chat to, must have been brilliant.
It can be a massive cost. I mean, let's be honest, there's nothing really about fertility struggles that's cheap. But
No.
I think people having the opportunity to be face to face with, let's say, a particular clinic that they were thinking of attending, but there's a
Yeah,
big
yeah.
difference between just seeing a glossy website and actually being face to face and actually being able to engage with people and ask them questions that you might not otherwise get the chance to ask. And that was something I was really encouraging people to do. Very first thing on sort of the Saturday morning, it was probably only about 10:30. There were a few people coming in, kind of grabbing leaflets and just running out the door because, we hadn't hit the throngs of people. But then, geez, that very quickly changed. And
Yeah.
once, the talks were up and running, I mean, there were crowds of people, genuinely. Like, it
Yeah,
was hard to
yeah.
get seats. And I think as well, you could see others looking around at each other, kind of going, wow, we're actually all in this together. Like, this is how common it is. Remember, fertility struggles of every type. I mean, it's 1 in 6, and some of the, statistics would indicate that it's even more common than that, like down to 1 in 5, which is more common than breast cancer, which
Oh.
affects 1 in 9. So when you consider how openly we discuss that, our level of awareness about it, I think it's about time that we were doing the same for fertility.
Yeah, and talking about it is that's kind of key, isn't it? Because a lot of the time, understandably, it's such a personal thing. It's such a private journey for a lot of people. There aren't open conversations often, but in that kind of environment, I would imagine it was a bit more, people probably felt a bit more comfortable to have the chats about it and to just,
Hugely, hugely. In
yeah.
fact, after my talk on the Sunday, just because I'd just spoken and I said, listen, if you want to ask me anything privately, you can come over to my stand. So there was kind of a queue of people waiting to chat. And it was really lovely as people took turns sitting down. They'd say, oh, I was just chatting to so and so in the queue. And I was like,
Yeah.
brilliant. So they were already sharing and being supportive of one another in their struggle, which is something that happens, of course, anonymously online. But there's just nothing like looking in the eyes of someone who gets it.
Yeah, totally. So I mean, we've had experts on talking about fertility before, and for me, I'm incredibly grateful to say that I haven't had to, avail of any fertility services in my parenting life so far, which is something, the more I hear about it's something that I genuinely do feel very grateful for, because it seems like an incredibly difficult process and something that's, not for the faint-hearted a lot of the time. But the last time we had an expert on, we were chatting about the kind of the basics of like primary infertility and just kind of what to expect when you go to an appointment and that sort of thing. But with you, I know you have a wealth of knowledge and such expertise in the area of fertility, but I would love to have kind of a chat with you about the topic of miscarriage and then secondary infertility. Because again, just like, fertility as a whole, miscarriage isn't talked about enough, and I think there is still a veil of secrecy around it, and there is still a sort of taboo, uncomfortable sense around it. And even for, like, I have close friends who have gone through miscarriage and fertility treatment and things like that, and I would be very open to talking about that sort of thing. I would be very comfortable in general having kind of difficult conversations, and even at that, I still sometimes don't know what to say or what's appropriate to say or how to broach the subject. So just from a very basic perspective, when someone is pregnant, maybe for the first time, or maybe not, I mean, a miscarriage can happen at any point, I suppose. But when someone miscarries, what can they expect? And that sounds a bit silly, but I
No, there's
wouldn't
no such thing as
know.
a silly
Do
question.
you know what I mean? Yeah, like
Yes.
I what can they what happens medically, physically? Where do you go? Who do you call?
Great. Okay, let's start there. So,
Yeah.
yeah, because there's so much to unpack. You're right.
There
Just
is.
listening to everything you were saying there, I know we could be here all day, from the emotional aspect, and indeed, like you said, the taboo stigma, you know, people blaming themselves, blaming their body for having, failed their baby, you know, which is an incredibly hard thing to deal with. So we have to talk about that. But then also going back to just the practicalities, like, of what actually happens.
Exactly.
Because you see, first of all, I suppose it's worth categorizing the different types of miscarriage, just so people can get their head around it a bit. And also to give some, or to, I suppose, debunk some myths. For example, a very early stage miscarriage, a chemical pregnancy, is really where the pregnancy is kind of over before it began, in the sense that you might feel that, you know, my period's a couple of days late. Do a urine test at home, because that's really all you'll have available to you. If you've been going through fertility treatment, of course, you might have had a blood test, or you could request one that will show that you were pregnant. But then very quickly, the numbers start to dwindle. So, like, within the space of a couple of days. So that means, you know, in the vast majority of cases, you're experiencing a miscarriage before the 5 week mark. And in that situation, it's really important to understand that it is a miscarriage. So some people are led to believe that a chemical pregnancy doesn't count, that they weren't really pregnant because they hadn't reached the point of having a scan, typically at the 7 week mark, showing that there was a fetal heartbeat, or I should say an embryonic heart rate at that point.
Yeah.
And that's really disconcerting to people, because they then think, so hang on, so those, if I've had three chemical pregnancies in a row, so they don't matter, they don't count, they absolutely do matter. The other thing to note is, of course, for an ectopic pregnancy, which is a form of miscarriage that occurs when the embryo actually implants in the tube. I mean, if you're talking about how that's managed, it's usually picked up on because a person tests positive that they're pregnant, but then when they go for a scan, they can't actually see anything within the womb. So they realize, uh-oh, you know, this is essentially a pregnancy of unknown location until proven otherwise. So each of these different situations, and obviously then a slightly later first trimester miscarriage, which can be a missed miscarriage. So in other words, maybe a person had a perfectly healthy scan at 7 weeks, saw the heartbeat, wonderful, great. But then they go back at 9 or 10 weeks or beyond, maybe sometimes at the 12-week scan, and discover to their heartbreak that actually their baby's heart had stopped beating, and essentially the pregnancy had stopped at about the 8-week mark, but it's now 10 or 12 weeks and it just hadn't been picked up on. So those are all quite different scenarios. In the case of a chemical pregnancy, it's really just what we call like a spontaneous miscarriage that happens at home. You're really just having a delayed period. Whereas by comparison to a miscarriage that would be later on in the first trimester, how that can transpire is usually one of two ways. Either a person starts to experience spotting, you know, a bleed. So they have some indication that something is amiss. It's important to say that I've seen many cases over the years who had spotting and their pregnancy was perfectly fine. Okay. So it does not always spell doom and gloom. But if we're talking about a common way that a person might have an indication of a miscarriage happening, they'll often describe perhaps feeling a bit differently, like maybe symptoms that they had start to abate quite suddenly. So maybe, you know, tender breasts, that would diminish, or they just, often the term they use is, I just felt different. And then they have spotting, and then they go in for a scan. So really, that's always kind of the first step, is to go in and get checked and see what's going on. Now, the problem about it is that even if on a scan, if they say, let's say, the heart rate is a little bit slow, or it's not, the size of the embryo isn't quite matching your dates. Even if they feel pretty convinced that a miscarriage is imminent, it's, you know, beholden upon them. It's just for insurance reasons. They have to scan you again a week later. Okay. So you're usually made to wait. And even if you know yourself, even if, you know, that night a really heavy bleed starts and you're like, oh, it's happening. You still have to go back in for a scan. And incidentally, that follow-up scan isn't just to be absolutely certain and to confirm the miscarriage. It's also for the fact that if someone has been going through it at home, as I said, sort of spontaneously, so I'll get to the other methods in a moment. If they're going through that, that they check within the scan to see that everything had cleared properly, because that's really important for avoidance of of infection risk. So in terms of then management, if, let's say, for the person who's experiencing a missed miscarriage, so they've gone in, they had no symptoms, they thought they were just having a lovely scan, so it is quite shocking to then discover that's not the case. They then have to wait another week, as I was saying, to go back for a follow-up scan. So if there's no movement, if it doesn't look like the body is trying to clear the pregnancy itself, then you move to either medicated or surgical. So you'd either be given a medication that would help to trigger the miscarriage to occur, or you opt for surgical, which is either termed as the DNC or ERPC. I didn't make these names up. ERPC stands for evacuation of retained products of conception. Not a very nice term for your baby, but that's what it's called. Or DNC, dilation and curettage, which they, forgive me, but they essentially go in and they remove the products themselves. Okay. So that process is obviously a tough one for people to decide on. For some people, they don't want the medicated route, because of course that means then having to go through the miscarriage themselves at home. Yeah. And equally, sometimes the choice might be taken from them. Maybe they'll be advised, well, based on the fact that you've been bleeding already, we're concerned about infection, so we would rather if you came in. And so it's totally individualized. You have to talk about that very carefully with your attending consultant, whoever's supporting you. But that's really the process of what someone goes through with miscarriage.
Would there be pain in any of those cases?
There can be, not always. So some people have a completely painless bleed. Others have very definite cramping and can feel like, no, something's happening. But I think perhaps one of the cruelest aspects of miscarriage is that it doesn't always manifest in the same way.
Yeah. So after, you know, you've had your miscarriage of whatever form it takes, and you've gone in for your DNC, or you've done whatever it takes to kind of get your body back to square one, in a sense. I know from speaking to people that trying again for another baby, another pregnancy, can be a difficult subject to broach, from an emotional perspective, obviously, and from a physical perspective. So are there any, like, what's best advice, I suppose, around trying again, or you know, trying to get pregnant again?
Well, I think there too, when you consider the types of miscarriage, I didn't even begin to touch on later term miscarriages.
Okay. Of course, so yeah.
The second trimester and beyond, which absolutely can occur. So I think it'll really depend on the individual circumstance, because I've seen it all over the years. I've seen a person go through one miscarriage and then descend into the depths of depression, not be able to go to work, not be able to function. And equally, I've seen others who've gone through four or five, and they have a kind of very resolute attitude to that. Oh, it's a numbers game. I just have to keep going. So there's no accounting for the individual.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really key thing to note, that there's a difference between your emotional recovery and your physical recovery. Mm-hmm. Physical, generally speaking, is fairly quick, but depends, of course, on what type of miscarriage you're going through. For example, with an ectopic pregnancy, if it can't be managed conservatively, where you keep your tube, in certain cases, you might have to have your fallopian tube removed. So it's just important to be aware there's different outcomes. But really, the emotional side, there is no timeline on that. And frankly, I think from all the people I've spoken to over the years who've gone through it, you know, I've received messages online from people who aren't even trying to conceive anymore. I'm talking about, you know, people who might be in their 50s or 60s. And they're following me because they're still looking for answers for why they have suffered a pregnancy loss maybe 20 years prior, which is just wild, because it just shows you how much of a lasting impact it has. Why it should never be dismissed as just one of those things. Bad luck, try again. Like all these phrases that I think are sometimes kind of parroted to people and shouldn't really be said so casually.
Like the insensitivity sometimes is staggering when you hear about the things that the phrases or the, look, at least, you know, you can get pregnant. Like those sorts of things are so damaging by all accounts, you know,
unbelievably undermining.
Yeah, completely.
Very much so. And I think as well, something you touched on when you're talking earlier about, you know, miscarriage then followed by secondary fertility struggles, something that I often try to remind people of is that struggling to get pregnant and struggling to stay pregnant are two sides of the same coin. And very often, I think there's this misrepresentation, like you said, at least you can get pregnant, you know, like that somehow is a brownie point. So therefore, it leaves those who haven't conceived yet or haven't been able to conceive feeling less than, feeling like, oh my gosh, so am I really damaged? And equally, it leaves those who have suffered the pregnancy loss feeling like they shouldn't grieve, that they aren't entitled to feel all their emotions about that miscarriage. So I think, yeah, it's definitely a phrase best left aside. It doesn't matter where you are on the spectrum of fertility struggles, whether you are younger or older, you know, whether, you know, you've been trying for 6 months or 6 years, whatever it is that you're going through personally, you're entitled to feel whatever it is you're feeling.
This podcast is just one way that Every Mum supports you. Another amazing way is our free gift bag, packed full of essentials for you and baby, including free samples of water wipes, the number one baby wipe in Ireland. To receive yours, register now on everymum.ie. There's a free gift bag there waiting for every mum.
Just to go back to the late stage miscarriages. So that, I suppose, applies to anything after 12 weeks. So you're into your second trimester and beyond. Okay. Mm-hmm. So in those situations, obviously, you're more progressed through your pregnancy. You've possibly even got a visible bump. You know, you've kind of, something I hear often is, we thought we were okay because we were past the 12 week mark. What kind of, you know, what considerations should someone have to, like, I almost think, you know, being prepared for something like that can be a good thing. And not to say that someone should worry that they're going to lose a pregnancy, you know, in the second trimester or the third trimester, but to have an awareness. Like, I had no awareness of, I had preeclampsia towards the end of my pregnancy, and I had never even Googled it. I'd heard of it, but only in passing. And I feel like had someone told me beforehand what that was going to involve and what was, you know, what was coming, I would have been a little more prepared. Mm-hmm. So for anyone that's listening, that's, you know, that would like to kind of have this information, what can happen later in pregnancies?
There's a lot. And I suppose why I'm cautious to share too many of the things is in the sense that you don't want to scaremonger people either. Yeah. Because it is important to say that, absolutely, you're right, preeclampsia, etc. We should have an awareness that these things can happen. Mm-hmm. But I think particularly in the context of, so for example, for someone who's been trying to conceive for many months, if not years, sure, they're already on tenterhooks about everything throughout the pregnancy.
Yeah.
That you don't want them overly stressing. You know, you brought to mind a client I had a number of years ago who, just like that, she was pregnant, had got past the 12-week mark, she now had reached, and throughout the whole pregnancy was, you know, telling me her stories of doom and gloom. And I remember she came into me at 32 weeks and she was quoting statistics to me about stillbirth. And I had to have a chat with her and I was like, look, listen, I was like, even if you gave birth today, you know, at 32 weeks, the baby's lungs are developed, you know, your baby would stand a good chance. And I said, you know, you need to start buying some stuff for your baby now, because she'd done no shopping. And I think it's just important to call out the fact that this disaster planning, which is totally normal, self-protective, it's an instinctive thing that we do, can obviously go quite far in that direction. Yeah. So there's a delicate balance, shall we say, between information overload and versus just being informed. So typically, well, the first thing to note is that any pregnancy loss moving into the second and indeed third trimester, because of course, as we now know from what's happening in the UK with issuing certificates, you know, for pregnancy loss prior to 24 weeks, that, you know, you don't, I mean, ask anyone who's gone through that. If you lose a baby at 23 weeks or 24 weeks, I guarantee you don't feel any different just because of how it's termed medically. So, you know, depending on what stage it's happened at, obviously there'd be different things that could be going on, but it's far less common than first trimester losses. So that's important to note for anyone who's scared of it happening. So things that they would investigate, number one would probably be the function of the placenta. So placental insufficiency, as it's sometimes known, or sometimes, as I had a client actually last week, when she was suffering a miscarriage at like the 12, 13 week mark, so she just moved into the second trimester, it looked like the placenta was essentially peeling off the uterine wall. So they suspected infection or a problem with the placental function. So you're usually looking at issues of blood clotting, thrombophilia, issues with immune balance, or, you know, basically the immune system acting as it shouldn't, which typically may involve things like attacking the placenta. There can be quite, again, rare things like CHI, chronic histiocytic enterovillositis, which is where the immune cells are interfering with how the placenta should be functioning. So therefore the body starts to reject the pregnancy.
Okay.
Then there's obviously physical things that can happen as well. typically not before maybe around the 14th to 15th week, would be, you might have heard of cervical insufficiency, which is where essentially the cervix can just open up and let go of a perfectly healthy pregnancy. So in that case, a person would be recommended a stitch or cervical circlage, it's called, which helps to actually strengthen that hold so that the pregnancy doesn't get, you know, got rid of essentially. But the thing to know is that you won't know that's going to happen until it's happened to you. So for someone with a history of that with cervical insufficiency, they typically will suffer that second trimester loss before it's speculated, oh, well, actually the placenta
that
was fine.
Could have been.
And then for the future, they would be recommended from early stage pregnancy, right? We'll put in the stitch so that we can avoid that in future. So in terms of, I suppose what you're getting at is what could a person avoid happening? That's very difficult if you're talking about second, third trimester losses, because, you know, yourself, like with preeclampsia, they've done tons of research, you know, apart from maybe there's some inkling about vitamin D, like there's not much they can say with certainty that can prevent it happening to someone. Or gestational diabetes as well, developing that later in the pregnancy, which can threaten it too. You don't have to be of a higher BMI to develop diabetes. You don't have to have had a history of diabetes before. So unfortunately, pregnancy can be a trigger for quite a lot of changes in someone's body that they just might not be able to anticipate.
And sometimes there's no mitigating. There's no lifestyle changes. There's nothing that you could possibly have done. And that brings me on to then, you said it earlier on, the idea of blame, you know, and guilt and feeling like your own body let you down in a situation. That must be an incredibly difficult burden to bear for people. So how do you, I really can't imagine how it must feel to think that your own body let you down and to blame yourself for something that really had nothing to do with you. How do you kind of counsel clients and patients, and how do you talk to people about that?
I would always try to explain it from the perspective of, first of all, why is it that we personalize fertility struggles, if you think about it? Because this doesn't just extend to those with eggs. You know, I spent a good deal of time chatting with guys over the Future Fertility Show weekend. You know, one fella telling me about his experience with testicular cancer and having to freeze samples. Another fella who'd azoospermia because of a genetic condition, so he produces no sperm. You know, so there's a wide variety of things going on out there across the board, you know, because it's very important to have fertility. It's not just a female issue, so to speak.
Of course,
So when I'm speaking with people, it's about removing the personalization, because if you think about it, people go through all sorts of stuff, you know. A person might be born with a hole in their heart and need surgery, or, you know, growing up might have a gammy hip and have to have surgery on that. For some reason, when it comes to fertility, perhaps because we're told since such a young age that it's the most natural thing in the world, and, you know, that's what we're here for, it's what we're designed to do, you know, whether we mean to tune into these things, these messages from society or not, they still tend to go into our minds. And unfortunately, that then tends to make people feel it's their fault, that they are broken in some way if it's not working. But if you spun that around and had the same conversation about, well, if you were told you had kidney failure, would you blame yourself for one of your kidneys not working? No, of course not. You know, most people, it's like nonsensical, that idea. But then, sure, why is it different with any organ, other organ in the body? Why is it different with the uterus? Why is it different with the ovaries? You know, with someone, let's say, who gets premature ovarian insufficiency and their ovaries essentially stop working and they go into early menopause. You know, these aren't, it's not personal. These are things that are just happening within the biology. But because of how we've been brought up, we tend to identify with that on a personal level. So I suppose essentially how I'm counseling people is to try to help them to detach from that and understand that this is never about blame for either partner, assuming conceiving partnered. It's really just about getting to the underlying causes, if they can be found, and then acting as best you can thereafter.
And what about that kind of language around miscarriage or fertility that minimizes the, you know, I don't know if minimizes is the right word, but like just that kind of, oh, it's grand, sure, it was nothing anyway, and it's grand, and it's fine, and, you know, at least you can get pregnant, you know, all those kind of phrases. They are obviously so difficult to hear. You know, anyone who's going through difficulty conceiving or fertility issues or anything like that. But what language can people use? What is the right thing to say? You know, like,
the most
how can
important
you
thing,
how can you support someone exactly in that without being insensitive to them?
Absolutely. The most important thing is that they feel heard. There is no, I think, you know what it really stems from? Just as you were talking there, I was thinking about a client who was talking about a friend of hers relaying the news that her father had passed away.
Okay.
And she sort of didn't know what to say in that moment. She sort of froze. And I think a lot of it stems from our discomfort with death, truly, you know, as a society.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not really in the Western world, if you think about it by comparison to other societies. Mm-hmm. We don't really talk about death, or it's not, you know, it's not a fun topic. So we don't really normalize it in the way that, you know, I suppose birth and death are part of life, as it were. So I think that spills over into what happens when someone suffers a pregnancy loss, is that people don't know what to say because we're not educated about it. And so they defer to things that, oh, well, I'll try to be helpful. So, you know, oh, well, at least you can get pregnant, you know, chin up, it'll be okay next time. And again, people, for the most part, I mean, I would say 99% of people, they're well-meaning, you know, they are trying to commiserate, but they just, they haven't been given the tools to do so. So I think the first and most important thing is that the person is heard. Just let them speak and let them communicate what they're feeling, without any need to respond or to fix the issue, which as humans, we're really not great at. We love to help, and we love to step in and kind of go, oh, but, or my friend did this, or, you know, we like to try and find some way of sort of putting salve on that wound. But sometimes the best thing you can do is just let it get some air. And that means allowing someone to communicate what they're feeling. Obviously, if you're with them face to face, and if appropriate, if you know them that way, give them a hug, hold their hand, support them, just let them express what they're actually going through without any conditions attached, I think is really the most important thing.
And is saying, you know, I'm sorry that happened, are those things helpful? Are they a hindrance? You know, because sometimes in those situations you want to...
I mean, well, if you can see that they're going through pain, then obviously saying like, I'm so sorry for this incredible pain you're going through.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could make it better for you, but I can't. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah,
I mean, that's the extent of it. And again, like I said, we feel like there's, even in my saying that to you there now, you know, there's like that uncomfortable pause of like, oh God, I have to sit there with that. I have to sit mm-hmm. with someone's pain. Mm-hmm. And that's not easy, particularly for those who are carrying their own pain.
Yes,
as a client recently who, interesting story, because in her work, she knows someone who's going through fertility struggles, who's been very open and very vocal about it. She herself doesn't feel as comfortable doing that. So she mm-hmm. is exhausted because she feels she's having to absorb her work colleagues' stories about her miscarriages and fertility struggles while she herself is actually going through the same thing. So mm-hmm. she doesn't really have the bandwidth for actually offering that because she needs support herself. So, you know, this is what I'm saying. You know, it's that common. I think people just don't realize that it's pretty guaranteed that there is someone you work with, or a neighbor or friend, or, you know, someone who's going through this, but you just mm-hmm. have no idea.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of, if we're talking about a partnership trying to conceive, and, you know, heterosexual partnership trying to conceive mm-hmm. that way, what can a partner who feels at a loss do when... Because look, if it's, like I said, if it's a heterosexual partnership and the woman is the person carrying the baby or the pregnancy, you know, even in the most straightforward of situations, mm-hmm. the father, the man, the partner can feel a bit, oh, what do I do here? How can I help? How can I be of use? In a situation where there's miscarriage or losses.
Of course, and I'd say the same,
yeah.
it works both ways. I mean, you know, I've seen with reciprocal IVF, you know, when someone's giving their eggs to their partner, whoever is the person going through the miscarriage, and if they have a partner, whoever their partner is, it's still going to be hard for them to watch what they're going through. And they're going to struggle probably with what to say, because, you know, there is nothing that can prepare you for it. And knowing how it feels to have that in your body, like in those very initial stages, the changes you feel, the physical kind of pulling, tugging sensations, because it is a different feeling as the pregnancy begins in the early weeks. You know, it's hard to be able to convey that in words to loved ones, to your partner or close family or friends, whoever's there to support you. It's hard to convey the depth of that feeling of loss. And so that's why it can be so hard for partners, because they're not physically going through it. So they do then feel helpless. And I think that's the biggest thing for any partner to understand, is that your role at that point is critical. But it's also important to note that it's not just about being supportive to your partner, because you're grieving too. And I think often that's what I see being overlooked. And particularly if we are talking about the sort of, you know, in a heterosexual sense, because of the fact that so much of the focus is always put on women anyway. It's always put on, you know, the person with eggs, they're the one who's carrying the baby, the eggs are most important. You know, all the focus is put there, that, you know, a fella can be sidelined. And I think it's just really important to note that they feel things just the same way. There is no such thing as, you know, oh, men are less emotional than women. Like, that's absolutely not true. I've borne witness to it. And I think that does just as much of a disservice to them if we make them feel that way, that you just need to be strong for your partner, you know, just carry them through it, because they're going through their own stuff too as well. So that's why I'm certain. Go ahead.
There is, sorry, I was just going to say, there is a lot of that. There, like, I remember when I was pregnant, I was having all sorts of complications. I was having chronic morning sickness. I had an awful time. I also had gestational diabetes, and I also had preeclampsia. So I was ticking loads of boxes. And one of the things that I kept, like, look, it was difficult for me, don't get me wrong. I didn't particularly enjoy being pregnant at all. But one of the things that kept happening was people would say to my husband, you know, one of the things that you just need to be strong for her, you just need to be okay for her. And it kind of did take away some of his agency in terms of, like, if he wanted to have a shit day, or if he wanted to be down or upset or worried about the baby or worried about how I was. So it does kind of minimize things for the partner at times, doesn't it, when it's just be strong for your partner.
Massively. And I mean, we already have that problem in society with, you know, like, boys don't cry, men shouldn't cry, you know, and that's, of course, complete nonsense and causes a lot of problems and repressed emotions and really deep, dark feelings not being able to be expressed and articulated. So, yeah, it's vital that that's called out as well, and that people understand that. And that's why what I was going to say there earlier is that, you know, in many cases, this is too much for a couple to deal with by themselves. And that's where outside professional support in terms of counselling or whatever is deemed necessary is worth exploring, because it's a lot of pressure to put on a relationship.
Mm-hmm. For you, as not as a professional, but as someone who, I mean, your friends, your family, people you meet will know what you do professionally. Do you always get at dinner parties or at hen parties or at whatever, do you always get the, can I just ask you a quick question? And I would imagine you do. And if so, what kind of questions are common, and what do people want to get from you for free?
I laugh when you ask that question, because I've never actually been asked that before in a podcast. I have been asked that by friends who know me, like, as in long time school friends, are just like, oh, you must get sick of it. I am not safe anywhere. The hairdresser, I was in the middle of a PT session, so I was with a physical trainer. And at the end of the session, she was telling me about her periods being absent and not there.
Oh my goodness.
Nowhere I'm safe. Even in the sauna. I had a chat with a woman who I thought, well, she's not of childbearing age, it's grand. She was in her 60s, but then, of course, as sure as she knew what I did, then we were talking about her daughter. So, yeah. But do you know what that showed? First of all, I have no problem with it. And I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. Because I know how common of an issue it is. I know how isolating it can feel. I mean, that was so evident from the response from people at the Future Fertility Show, that they were just agog that there could be this many other people going through it, even though you kind of know, or you've been told online the statistics. So I feel if I can help in any way, then I want help. Of course, I'm not going to just start a full-blown consultation in the middle of a party or anything. But if I can give someone, you know, a few words that will direct them in the right direction. I mean, look, I've answered Instagram DMs on Christmas Day. Like, and that's because people go through miscarriages on Christmas Day. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, they've no one else to reach out to, or they've delivered their baby. So like, it's I'm either dealing with joys of despair or joys of joy or tears of joy, I should say. So, you know, it's an interesting spectrum of human emotion that I'm exposed to. But by all accounts, I feel very privileged, frankly, to be able to offer some support.
It's so generous of you, really, because like, there's been plenty of times, like, I'm, you know, my profession is or has been for the last 15 years as a journalist and as a podcaster and as a writer. And I will often lie about my profession to people just so I don't have to give them, you know, oh, could you have a quick look over this essay? Or can you just look at my CV and tell me, you know, or do you have a contact for whatever, whatever? And I'll just say, you know, I'm an accountant, or I'll say something that no one will want to probe. You know, that's I'm from brilliant. Revenue. I work for revenue.
Boring.
Don't ask me questions because I might, you know, look for your tax documents. Yeah. So it is incredibly generous of you that you do take the time and that you do get back to DMs on Christmas Day. And I love that you see it as a privilege.
I just love what I do. I mean, I'm incredibly lucky that I discovered very early on. Well, I'm lucky in a couple of, I'm lucky that I met my husband so early. I was only 21 when I met him, because obviously I see plenty who are trying to conceive. You're like, it's not that I wanted to be 40 having my first one, but like, this is when I met the love of my life. Like, what am I supposed to do, you know, to settle? So I was lucky that I met him young, and I'm lucky that I discovered my passion young as well. And that was only through falling ill while studying law. So yeah, I could have been on a very different path. So I completely understand what you're saying about, you know, being asked questions. But I think, yeah, if you're happy with what you do and it doesn't feel like work, which mine doesn't, because I mean, I read research before bed like it's a nighttime novel, you know. That's genuinely, as sad as it sounds, is what I like. So, you know,
it's not sad at all. It's not sad,
you know,
at all.
So therefore, yeah, I feel if when I, it's, it, do you know what it's about? It's that look on someone's face. When I see that look of just loss and despair shift slightly, and I can see a glimmer of, oh, maybe that's why I do it.
That's magic. Yeah. And it really is life changing work. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of people would say, you know, you hear someone talking about their career or how seriously they take something, and that, well, you know, we're not curing cancer here. It's, you know, it's not that important. What you do really is very much life changing for people.
True. But on the same, by the same token, like my daughter, who's now 16, like, she's very creative, and it'd be very easy to dismiss all the beautiful creative stuff in the world. I'd be lost without her. Sure, I don't know what the house would look like, because she has the creative eye. She sees things that I don't see. So I think it's all about the balance that we all bring, because, you know, I'm useless at maths. So if it wasn't for my accountant, again, I don't know where I'd be, or bookkeeper, you know what I'm saying? So I think, it's just about balance and all things, really.
True. And I always rag on accountants. I don't know why I choose that profession. I'm very sorry to all the accountants listening. I'm sure you love your work.
Great. Exactly. And they do. Yeah.
And just lastly, before I let you go, I'm fascinated to know if there are any, I suppose, reassuring nuggets of information, or maybe a statistic, or maybe something that you call upon when you speak to someone to just give them that, to bring that spark of hope to them, just to say, well, look, yes, you had a miscarriage, or yes, you're having this problem, or yes, whatever's going on for you, but here's what I know. Are there kind of a couple of nuggets of information that you give to people to make them have that bit of comfort?
There are. And I suppose it goes as follows, which is that you can control for what you can control, and you can't control the other thing. So, for example, you know, someone's stressing endlessly about their turning 40, you know, my 40th birthday, it's all over for my fertility. You can't control turning 40. No one can control their date of birth, but you can control digging deeper, looking at your overall health. Are there any secondary health conditions you need to address? You know, how are your hormones, nutrient levels? Is everything on point that you can control to support your fertility? And by the same token, for those with sperm, same deal, you know, because the sperm are made afresh every day. So I think people, maybe just due to a lack of education, it's not their fault, they don't realize how much autonomy they actually have over the process. And, you know, if you're not happy with any element of your fertility care, move elsewhere. You're the one who's in charge. Don't let anybody else dictate to you. I always say that it's about being given all the options and information so that you can make an informed decision, because that's empowering for people rather than feeling lost and, you know, at the behest of someone else telling you what to do.
Yeah. And statistically, you know, is there anything that someone could have in mind to go, okay, I could potentially be the 80% rather than the 20% or something like that?
Like the fact that most couples, I think it's like 87.5 or something, and most couples should conceive inside of a year, for example. The fact that, you know, with miscarriage, like a first time miscarriage is very common, regardless of age, actually. But once it hits two or beyond, there's usually underlying factors going on which need to be investigated and are things that you can do something about, you know, for most cases.
I suppose it is all about, you know, control and being able to do some, like being able to take action, I suppose, is comforting in itself, knowing that there is a route to go down. And just quickly before, like I said, before I let you go, the legislation that was passed recently about fertility and the government covering costs for some people, it's incredibly exclusionary. But cost wise for people, I know that that is a huge, huge worry when it comes to, because look, there are routes you can go down, there are treatments you can get, but oftentimes it's out of budget for a huge number of people. Is there anything that you would say to someone who's worried about that, who's worried about the cost, you know, what can be done in those situations if it's cost prohibitive?
Yeah, it's really, I'd say it's fairly simple in some respects, in the sense that what cost we're talking about is invariably going for a cycle of fertility treatment. If you're going for a cycle of IVF or ICSI, where they inject the sperm into the egg, that's what ICSI is. If you're doing that, you're usually talking about around, you know, $5,000 minimum and moving up from there, depending on whatever add-ons or they're testing. So the first thing I'd say to someone is prepare. Take a few months to prepare before that cycle, even if you're over 40. Get your ducks in a row. Make sure all relevant testing has been done, because why proceed with a cycle if, I mean, like a couple I was speaking to this morning, if your iron markers are off and the sperm quality is off and your vitamin D levels are deficient and you're crazy stressed with work and you have a sick parent and you know what I'm saying? You have too much going on to be able to give this your full attention. You know, if you're going to invest heavily in something, and weirdly with fertility treatment, I can't actually think of anything else in life. If you think of like investing in stocks and shares or anything, I can't think of something comparable to fertility for how much people invest for so little potential return. If you get me, in terms of the statistics, odds of success, because if you're like in your late 30s and you're going for a cycle, you know, you've about maybe 23-25% chance with a non-genetically tested embryo. Of course, it's much higher if the embryo is genetically tested, could be 60-70% chance of success. But it just seems odd to me that we wouldn't try to do everything possible to maximize you having that best cycle in advance.
Yeah. So there are things that you can do, lifestyle changes you can make that are free, that can put you in the best position if you do decide to go down the road of full IVF treatment.
The things that are way either free or way cheaper than actually going for fertility treatment. But we are led to believe, you know, rightly or wrongly, just with the messaging that's out there, that there's nothing we can do, that it's just about your age and that's it, end of story. And that's not true. Been my experience.
Jessica, like, I definitely could sit here for another 2 hours. I'm sure there are so many more questions that I could and should talk to you about. So maybe down the line a little bit.
But I'd be delighted.
In the meantime, thank you so much for giving us your time and your expertise today. Really, really appreciate it.
Not at all. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening, and of course to Waterwipes, the number one baby wipe brand in Ireland, for their support. Waterwipes Original are made with just two ingredients, 99.9% water and a drop of fruit extract. And they are plant-based and plastic-free wipes. If you enjoyed this conversation, subscribe, rate, or we would love if you could leave a review. Share this episode across social if you want, and get in touch with this week's guest.